Okay, this doesn't necessarily mean this class will go well, but it's kind of a good class to have now, because by definition, it's got to be kind of rapid fire, because we got 85 minutes and 16 questions, which means we'll park on an average of about 5 minutes apiece. Some of them more, some of them less. All of you know one of the questions we're going to be covering. Here's the other 15. Some of these I'll have a little bit more to say on. Some of them I don't have hardly anything to say on. And you'll be able to identify which are which. Okay. First question is the one that's on the program that some of you, most of you have seen is, did Methuselah die in the flood? Well, I could answer that in about three words, but let's go back to Genesis chapter 5 and take a look. Because you might say, well, why consider questions if they're unanswerable? Well, that's not a bad question. But I think the answer is, seriously, we don't want to get bogged down with them, but we can still learn in discussing them, and we can eliminate some wrong answers. I happen to think a few of them on that list are answerable. At least in my mind they are. And I'll let you make your own conclusions. How many generations from Adam to the flood? 10. Okay. So I'd like for you to take a look at Genesis chapter 5. And what I want to do, this first one is Adam. Obviously he had sin. Give me how many years here? In other words, how old was Adam when he had sex? 130. Okay. Now go to the next one. How old was Seth? 105. Just keep going. 90. 70. 65. 162. 65, 187, 182. Do we agree with Thomas? Okay. Now, someone that has either a calculator or just a good mathematician, I'd like for you to add up these numbers down to here and down to here. And what that will give us is how many years after Adam was started did Methuselah and Noah were they born or started as you hush your Adam. On here. Okay, 687. What do we get down here? 687, right? No, I mean all the way. Add it to that. Okay. According to that genealogy, Noah would have been born 1,056 years after Adam. So, I don't know whether I should say Adam was born or not created, whatever. So that puts the flood when? How old was Noah when the flood hit? 600. So we've got the flood at 1,656 years from the creation. How long did Methuselah live? Pardon? Okay. So, what year did Methuselah die? 1656. Now, the question is, did Methuselah die in the flood? That we don't know. What we do know is Methuselah, it appears, died in the year of the flood. Okay? Was Methuselah a righteous man? I say apparently not. if Noah was the one that was. I'm not trying to be the judge, and maybe something happened, but I would lean toward not. Tom? Yeah. I think he died in the year of the flood, but before the flood. Absolutely. That's why we don't know. We don't know if he died in the flood. We know he died, I believe, the year of the flood. Well, that wouldn't make him righteous either way, whether he died before the flood or in the flood. Would it? Years before the flood. Okay. Methuselah probably wasn't righteous. But, I mean, he could have... You die hard, don't you, Tom? You die hard. Huh? Well, was Lamech righteous? He had a good grandson. But if you do the math, I think you're going to have the same issue with Lamech too, whether he died in the flood or the year of the flood. Okay? Again, not trying to beat the horse, but I think it is kind of neat to kind of see how this all fits together. And, you know, as I was thinking about this question, and I've probably said it to young classes a lot, you know, who was the oldest man that ever lived? Methuselah. Probably not. He's the oldest man recorded. But there were probably 200, 250 million people alive at the flood. If Noah's grandfather happened to be the oldest of all of them, it would be, to me, rather coincidental. But I don't know. But he's the oldest recorded. But the only reason he's recorded is he's in the lineage of Noah. That's where this whole thing is. If someone other than Noah had been the one righteous man, then all these names would change. Because they were giving us the genealogy that would bring us up to us. And we all came through Noah. Anybody have a comment or a question or, feel free to disagree when they're unanswerable questions. You have lots of leeway. But we can get wrong answers, and we want to try to make sure we don't come up with wrong conclusions, even though we might have multiple right conclusions. Okay. I'm just going to go down this list, and we'll spend a little bit of time on them. I don't think we know for sure the answer to this next one. Did Solomon repent? Now, Tom, I think maybe it was the first day when he was doing Ecclesiastes, made some comments that he kind of felt Solomon had repented. And I don't want to put words in his mouth. I think Mike kind of alluded to that today also. And usually, and they can correct me if this wasn't their thinking, you know, we think of him as being a rather foolish young man who finally got things figured out, and then he wrote Ecclesiastes later on, and you kind of reach the conclusion that maybe he turned his life around. And that may be true, but I'm not convinced that it's true. So I'll give you a way of looking at a non-repentant Solomon, and the reasons I think you can make a case for that, and then you can make your own conclusion. And we need to go to 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 4. And we were just in 1 Kings with Mike just a few moments ago. In 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 4, it says, "For it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned him away to other gods." So the simple notion that he did all of this foolishness when he was young and then was totally righteous when he was old, I suspect you could make an argument against that. And if you go down through this particular chapter, in verse 40, the last recorded act in this chapter that Solomon is trying to do before he dies is kill Jeroboam. Now, I don't know how much time elapsed between Jeroboam going to Egypt and coming back. I don't know how much time elapsed between Solomon trying to kill Jeroboam and him dying. I don't know whether Ecclesiastes was written before he tried to kill Jeroboam or after, So we can't answer it for sure, but I would say, and I had held this for some time, kind of an assumption that Ecclesiastes and Proverbs tells us that Solomon got his act together and was a righteous man in his old age. Well, there's some indications here in 1 Kings 11 that there might be a little bit of room for holes in that theory. Okay? I suspect Solomon did repent, but I don't know whether he was righteous when he died. I suspect he's like a lot of us. He repented numerous times in his life. And maybe somebody has some insights into that you would like to share that I have missed. I'll pause. Rick? Okay, I would put him a tad older than me, but not much. Yeah. Some of the reading I've seen is putting in his early 50s. That's about a match. How old do you think Solomon was when he began to reign? Well, then he reigned for 40 years. 57. Okay. I'd put him about 20, so I'm not going to split hairs on it. But he was not an old man when he died. Even by any standard. By any standard. To me, the inference here in chapter 11 is it seems toward the end of his life, however old he was. Yeah, it does say old. Okay, thank you. Anybody else care to make a comment or ask a question? It's just a discussion. I'll give you my best thinking and defer to yours. Okay. Let me see if I have anything else I want to say. Or I might give you Nehemiah 13:26. Makes a comment about Solomon. Doesn't answer the question, but it makes a comment about it. Are there extra papers at the back, or did we run out? A question. Okay. I was going to Nehemiah. I'm sorry, I got distracted. Does somebody have that? Nehemiah 13:36. You can just read it. Okay. And that doesn't answer our question, but it does indicate he was loved by God, but the pagan women did cause him much problems, which may well be a reference to what we saw there in 1 Kings chapter 11. Okay. Anybody else want to say anything on number two? Number three. Who wrote the book of Hebrews? Well, that's one of the books in the Bible we don't know for sure. It doesn't say. A lot of books do say. The book of Hebrews doesn't say. I'm going to give you some reasons for a lot of people, and I lean this way, ascribe it to Paul. And I'm going to give you some reasons why I think that's a valid. And I'll give you some arguments as to why people who don't think it was written by Paul might give you. Okay? The phraseology at the close of the letter, "Grace be with you all," is a very familiar phraseology that Paul tends to use at the end of almost all of his epistles. So that would be a pro-Paul point. But to balance that out, Peter uses that similar phraseology to close 1st and 2nd Peter. So that doesn't, in my opinion, prove it one way or the other. A lot of the early church fathers or historians, Clement of Alexandria, Justin Martyr, they ascribed it to Paul. Does that prove Paul wrote it? No. But there is some validity in that. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 23, we get a slight clue. "Know ye that our brother Timothy is set at liberty." So the writer of Hebrews knew Timothy and appeared to have some kind of a positive, close relationship with Timothy. That would fit Paul, but it would also fit other people, to be quite honest about it. Verse 24 of chapter 13, there is a phrase, "Salute all them that have rule over you and all the saints. They of Italy salute you." And some have taken that to be an indication that it may have been written by Paul while he was in prison. Is it a proof text? No. Is it a possible inclination? Supporting it, yes. The strongest argument that, for me, that I found against it being Paul, and I already told you I lean toward it being Paul, is found in Hebrews 2 and 3. In the second chapter of Hebrews, verse 3, that famous verse, "How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord?" And this is the phrase, "that was confirmed unto us by them that had heard him." And that is sometimes taken as an indication that the writer of Hebrews had had the Lord's words confirmed to him by people who had heard the Lord, seen the Lord, confirmed it. Well, that's a little bit contrary to what you find in Galatians 1 and 11, where he said he received it of a revelation of God and not of man. I think I can explain verse 3 away, because, I don't want to explain it away, but explain it. Let me put it that way. In Acts chapter 13, verse 31, Paul speaking says, speaking about Jesus, "And he was seen by many days of them that came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are his witnesses unto the people." Paul refers to people that were witnesses of Christ and doesn't seem to include him in that, himself in that. So he may have simply in Hebrews 2 and 3 been referring to people that witnessed his earthly ministry in a more intimate relationship. So I don't think Hebrews 2 and 3 excludes Paul. But if I were making an argument why it's probably not Paul, I would certainly cause that to be part of my argument. The reality of it is, as one early historian wrote, only God knows. That's the bottom line. So it is in that sense unanswerable. If I were to give you my best guess or my best opinion or the way I think the evidence tends to lean, I would say it was probably Paul. But if it wasn't Paul, it's inspired, and that's all that we need to be comfortable with. And it was accepted by the early church and the early fathers as a divine text from the Lord. Questions, comments on that? Mike? Yeah. And has led some to suggest that possibly Barnabas or Luke did that translation. I've read that some thought this was a sermon by Paul that Luke wrote down, and therefore you have the Greek influence. I can't say that's impossible, but you can make monkeys jump through any kind of hoop you want. You're getting in there. Apollos, it's been ascribed to Apollos. It's been ascribed to Priscilla and Aquila. Just go down kind of the who's list of the New Testament characters, and somebody has said that. Tom? You know, and some of the early fathers and the historians were not inspired, but they were within decades, certainly within a century of when this actually occurred. So I do lend some weight to some of their thinking, but they vary on their thinking. Kevin? That's why you lean the other way. There's some validity to that argument. I can counter that by saying, if I know I'm writing to a different audience, I may change my style and my mannerisms and my approach too. And it is to a Jewish audience as opposed to a mixed audience or to a Gentile audience. Okay. Clint. That's possible. One of the things we're asked to talk about in a little bit is discuss the thorn in the flesh. But, I think the thorn in the flesh has got almost limitless possibilities. There are some indications maybe of what it was. That's possible. It's possible. Huh? And that would be? Yeah, that is one of the arguments for Paul, that he intentionally didn't identify himself because in Jewish circles he would have been somewhat of a black sheep. So, you can make all kinds of cases, and I'm not going to try to tell you which way it is because I don't know. I lean toward Paul. Mike? Yeah. That has a little bit of niceness to it. Okay, how long were Adam and Eve? Adam and Eve. How long were Adam and Eve in the garden? Okay. All kinds of good help. They're both right, I think. There was a time when I was probably college age that I wondered, maybe we don't know. I don't any longer really feel that. Usually people like to, it's been my experience, when people want to say, well, we don't know and it could have been any amount of time, they're looking for an opening for theistic evolution, is what they're looking for, because evolution has to have time, so you either got to make the 7 days of creation each a million years, or you got to have Adam and Eve in there for however many million years. But I don't accept that anymore. Mike's right, as long as they were allowed, but I believe Tom is right also, and let me tell you why. In Genesis chapter 5, verse 3, which we were just at, I take the wordage there very important. It says, and Adam lived 130 years before he had Seth. Okay? Now, I don't know that I tend not to think Adam aged until the fall and he was cast out of the garden. But it doesn't say he aged, it said he lived. And I believe Adam started living as soon as he was created. Therefore, from the time Adam was created until he had Seth was 130 years. Well, he was cast out of the garden in chapter 3 before chapter 4 when we have Cain and Abel and then subsequently Seth. So it seems to me he was cast out of the garden before Seth, which means he was cast out of the garden under that 130-year period that we've got up here. Was it here, 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 or here? I don't have any idea. But I'm confident from the wordage that he was cast out of the garden before he had Seth, which would be 130 years. So it doesn't, in my mind, leave any room for a long period of time for evolution because Adam and Eve were in the garden for 500,000 years or 500 million years. Unless you want to say live doesn't mean live, but I think even in the garden before death took it, started ravaging their bodies, if you will, he was alive. So he lived. So I think you've got a cap of 130 years. Tom? Okay. Anybody want to ask a question or make a comment on that or ask for clarification if what I said, I'm not asking you to always agree with me, but I want to make sure I speak so that you understand my point of view. Where was the Garden of Eden at? Yeah. Huh? The reference that the Tigris and the Euphrates has led some to believe that maybe is in the Fertile Crescent, which would be Mesopotamia, and that may be true. But if the flood did what we understand it did, and at least I feel it did, created mountains and changed the whole topography. Who knows? Who knows? It's been placed in Ethiopia. It's been placed in Missouri. It's been placed in Mesopotamia. Oh, really? There's, well, it's not there, but you can go and they'll, you know. So, is there, well, there can't be one in Kansas. Yeah. No one, no, I don't even want to joke about the Bible, so I'm not even going to say that. Where, Rick? Hendricksville? Okay, we settled it. It's in it. Seriously, it's very interesting and I think very, very telling that God makes a special, I think He makes a special point of not allowing us to know where a lot of places are because He knows you'd turn them into idols and worship them. You know? I think that's probably why we don't know, we don't have the Ark of the Covenant. We don't know exactly where Jesus was crucified. I mean, we know it was in Jerusalem, but we don't know the exact site. On and on and on. It's the providential hand of God just wants to take those physical things and turn us into spiritual beings. I'm firmly convinced. Yeah. We build a church, well, not we. Some people build a church on every site so that even if it were the right site, it's no longer the site. You know, and that was one of my great disappointments when I went to it. I had the privilege of going over there. It seemed like 80% of what I wanted to see had some kind of building on it that ruined what it looked like, even if it was the right place. So, be that as it may, God is a spirit. Anybody want to comment any further on the Adam and Eve in the garden? Pretty good chance it's not there. And even if it were, they don't know it. They don't know it. Okay. 1 Peter chapter 3. Verses 18, 19, and 20. First Peter chapter 3, verses 18, 19, and 20. I'll read those. For Christ also hath once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but quickened by the Spirit, by which also he went and preached unto the spirits in prison, which sometime were disobedient, when once the long suffering of God waited in the days of Noah. I'm going to stop there because we've covered the phrases that are in our question. Number 5, is 1 Peter chapter 3, 18 to 20, saying Christ spoke to the lost in Noah's day. What think ye, brethren? Okay. Wade says, through the Spirit by Noah. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, I agree with Wade. And let me give you a little flesh on the bone. Is that passage saying that Christ spoke to the lost in Noah's day? Yes. The question is, how did Christ speak to them? If you look at the text, my best rendering of it is, if you notice at the last part of verse 18, being put to death in the flesh by the quickening by the Spirit, by which, so the by which refers back to the Spirit. Okay? By which also he, Christ, or Noah, we'll talk about that in a minute, went and preached unto the Spirit. I understand, my best understanding of this is Christ did preach to the lost before the flood, but he did it through the agency of the Spirit that then used Noah as the preacher. Okay? If I were going to translate that, I would read it this way. Christ, through the power of the Holy Spirit, spake to the lost in Noah's day through the agency of Noah. That to me is the most logical interpretation of that passage. And it is an important thing because you can look at this and say, well, when Christ died and in those 3 days he was in the tomb, and basically in Acts when it says he went to hell, which we know that that's not quite true, he went to paradise. They say, well, maybe during during that entombment, he went to hell and preached to the lost people in hell. That's not what I see this passage saying at all. Thomas? Okay. Okay, if you'll just hold just a minute, that's question number six. Okay, and I'm not dodging it. I just want to get through five. Wade? I was trying to think, and can anyone think of a time where the Holy Spirit directly went and preached to sinners without going through the agency of an angel or a prophet or a human being? I couldn't. I'm not willing to say there isn't. I just couldn't think of any. It seems to me God's always, or the Holy Spirit, which is God, is using the agency of angels, prophets, inspired men, or men with the inspired words, which would be us. So, the point being, using Noah to do it is consistent with the way God seems to have worked all through time. Okay? Anybody else have something on five? Tom? Okay. There's interesting, I'll just give you these passages, I won't turn to them. Isaiah 42 and 7 and Isaiah 49 and 9 also predicted that Jesus would preach to the, or commented that Jesus would preach to the people in prison. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we get to question six. Question number six, who are the spirits in prison? I believe the spirits that we have referred to there in verse 19 are the spirits of the people that Noah preached to before the flood. Okay? Now, when Noah preached to them, they weren't simply spirits, but at the time Peter wrote this, they were spirits, because they had all died. Okay? They had cast off their bodies. The in prison, I think you can legitimately take that either of two ways. I'll tell you the way I tend to take it. Some people view the in prison as being the confinement of Hades or hell or torment, and some people view it as the confinement of the darkness of sin. But when you're in prison, dark cell, you know, that metaphor works. Well, I think either one, I could make either one of those as a true statement. Okay? I tend to look at it as the imprisonment of sin. But if you want to look at it the other way, it's not a contentious point with me. And one of the reasons I tend to do that is if you'll look down in chapter 4, verse 6. For this cause was the gospel preached also to them that are dead. I think the word dead there is reference to spiritual dead. Okay, because in verse 5 it talks about the quick and the dead. Which would be the spiritually alive and the spiritually dead. So, the one thing we want to make sure we understand is this is not a teaching that people that have died and are in torment are going to get preached to and have a second chance. Because then we're into purgatory. And these passages are about the closest you can get in our Bible to a justification of purgatory, but it's not what they're meaning at all, as I understand. Richard. Okay, if your question is, why does he say spirits in 19 and soul? Okay, well, I believe when we die, our body is separated from our spirit and our soul. So in the sense of talking about people that are no longer physically alive, they mean the same thing. They're not synonyms. They are two different words, and our spirit and soul are two different elements. But I think in both verse 19 and 20, we're talking about people whose spirits and souls are separated from their bodies, signifying that they are now dead. Anybody see that a better way? And I will certainly not be offended if somebody has a better insight or a better explanation. That's my understanding. This isn't one of my questions, but I've been asked. Noah was a righteous man. Were his sons and wives? What makes it? Tom says yeah, so let's let Tom, if he would care to. I was asked that one time, and my reaction was yes, but when I went back and looked, and I may have missed it, Noah's the one that's described as righteous. I like to think his family was, but it says they were saved. Well, they would need to be saved to some extent to propagate mankind. But were they righteous or not? It's kind of like the death angel. You know, we all say, well, the death angel passed over. When you go back and read the Bible never says death angel relative to the tenth plague. It says God passed over. I'm not saying he didn't use an angel. It just doesn't say that. And those are things I get. You know, the things you hear from childhood and you just say, it's gotta be in there. Then you go try to find it and it's not there. Thomas? That could be, but in verse 21 he says, and likewise now you're spiritually saved through baptism. Okay. Well, I probably made a strategic error by putting one more question into a pot that I'll have trouble getting through anyway. Okay? I just found that interesting. Anybody else want to comment here on 1 Peter 3 before we leave? It is an important passage. It's a good important passage on baptism too. Okay. Why did Enoch and Elijah not have to die? Well, I mean, I don't want to be flippant. It beats me. I understand why they didn't have to die, because they were righteous men, but why them and not somebody else? Well, there might not have been that many righteous men in Enoch's time, but we know there were several thousand in Elijah's time. So, your thoughts on that are probably going to be as good as mine. I came up with some thoughts such as, possibly it was a sign of the destiny to the wicked people of righteous people, an indication of the result of remaining steadfast, maybe an indication of God just choosing to show his power at that particular time. What I found more interesting personally, and I know the Bible says that they didn't die, you know, in Hebrews, Enoch mentioned in Genesis 5, and then in Hebrews 11, and then again in Jude 14, we're going to talk about the Jude 14 in a minute, and it says he didn't die. So my question to you is, death is the separation of the body from the soul and the spirit. And Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 says, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom. So, how did they not die? And I sure don't want to be arguing with the Bible, because it says they didn't die, but I think what it must mean is, they didn't die as we're used to seeing people. There had to be a changing of the flesh and the blood, and maybe even a separation, so that when they come back. So, I can make a technical argument that they died in that their body and their soul and spirit were changed or separated, but it wasn't a death like we see God took them up into heaven. So, I don't want to confuse anybody there. I just find that interesting to try to mesh, you've got to be able to mesh those passages together. Tom? We won't die in the sense that everyone else is dying. We will have to give up our flesh and our current flesh and blood into a changed, incorruptible flesh. Pardon, Clint? It says they were translated, I believe, in I think Genesis says it, and Hebrews also. Genesis doesn't mention they don't die. It just says they were, to get the exact word, they were no more, you know. So the people around Enoch may not have known what happened. I don't know. People around Elijah knew what happened. I mean, they saw something, but they might have thought Enoch just got eaten. I don't know. But the Bible tells us. Yeah, could have been. That would have been a sobering moment. I mean, talking about being thrown in the swimming pool and having to learn how to swim, you know. He's leaning on him and then all of a sudden he's gone. But to Elisha's credit, it says he picked, in 2 Kings 2, he picked up the mantle and he went back across. That's a lesson for us. You know, some of the older people that we've relied on for years, they gradually, or maybe not so gradually, depart. We've got to pick up the mantle and go on. Rex? Yeah. That might be an understatement. Yeah, we couldn't do it. We couldn't do it. Thought I saw another hand when I went to Rick. Tom?
I think you're right.
This is an embellishment of the Genesis 5, but I was once reading a commentary on Enoch, because it says in Genesis 5, Enoch walked with God. And this guy said, it's like Enoch and God went on a walk, and God looked at him and said, we're closer to my house than we are yours, so why don't you just come home with me? And that's really a neat thought. I mean, you walk with God so much that you end up being closer to His home than you are to your own home. Closer to heaven than you are to earth. I know that's an embellishment, but I've never forgotten that. I thought that was a wonderfully phrased image. Anybody else? Okay, number 8. Did any prophesy more than in Jude? This is a reference to Jude chapter 4, verse 14. Jude writing here said, and Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000 of his saints. Well, we know that it's this Enoch, because Jude says the seventh from Adam. You know, Enoch wasn't that probably uncommon a name, so Jude specifically identifies that it's a prophecy from Enoch. Did Enoch prophesy more than what we have here in Jude? Probably so. Can I say definitively? I'm not sure that I can, but probably so. Now, the Old Testament doesn't call him a prophet. Now, there's two groups of books that I just want to mention, and some of you are familiar with these. There's the Apocrypha, and I always struggle with this word, Pseudepigliographica, and that's probably not right, but I got all the letters in there. The Apocrypha, and these were books that tended to be written, say from 200 BC to 80 or 50 BC. And they're not in our Bible. They're not canonized because they're not inspired, and they weren't considered to be inspired. Now, in the Pseudepigraphia, there is a series of books called the Books of Enoch. If I remember right, there's three of them. And in Enoch 1, there is a passage that is almost identical to what we have here in Jude, verse 14. So some people would think, well, Jude quoted from Enoch 1. And that's possible. Or Enoch 1 and Jude may have both been quoting from an oral tradition that came down through Jewish history. What we do know is that this quotation is true because an inspired man and the Holy Spirit included it in the Bible. Now, not all of the things in the books of Enoch, if you want to go to and look them up, are inspired. So don't take them to the bank. But we do know this particular one is. Up in verse 9, he makes a reference about Moses that you're not going to find in the Old Testament. And it appears that it may have come from what's called the Assumptions of Moses, which are another book in that series. But we can rest assured that these are true because they include, it's kind of like when, remember Paul a couple of times quoted, poets. Well, those weren't inspired poets, and probably most of what those poets wrote was wrong. But when Paul included it, we know he was quoting it correctly. Okay. So that, I think, is the essence of that. Did Enoch prophesy more than just this one line? I would say probably, but I don't know how to verify that. Where are those prophecies? Well, the books of Enoch were written by somebody. And then they ascribe the name of Enoch on it so that people will think that it was maybe written by Enoch, but it wasn't. But there may be some true prophecies in there. I haven't line by line gone through those books, but they are available. But the key is that because we know Jude was inspired, we know that this particular passage, and that's a tremendous thought. If Enoch, the seventh from Adam, knew that the Lord is going to come back with 10,000 of his saints. That's quite an insight for as early as that is in the civilization of man. Okay, does anybody else want to... Oh, I was going to show... This Grant was very kind and tried to help me make some overheads. But they're a little small, but I think we've got them. It's not one of the questions, but it's interesting. The Apocrypha, and Enoch isn't in the Apocrypha, I just want to make one comment about it. And I know this is going to be a little hard to see. And I didn't bring my better overhead from home, and that's a bad on me. But this is the book of the Old Testament. That's the wrong, I didn't want that one yet. I want this one. Pardon me. These are the books of the Old Testament, i.e. the Hebrew Bible. Does anybody remember how many books, or scrolls, or whatever you want to call them, are in the Hebrew Old Testament? 24. But the Hebrew Old Testament is identical to the one we have. And you'll notice on here, if you can see, that, for instance, we've got Samuel and King, whereas we've got 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd King. So, they had one called the Book of the 12. We've broken that up into 12 minor prophets. So, when you do that, you get from 24 to 39. But it's the same content. Ezra and Nehemiah were together. Chronicles was all together. My understanding of why we have 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings has to do with the translation. When it was translated into Greek, it became much more voluminous, and it wouldn't all fit on one scroll. So, Kings had to be 1st and 2nd Kings, is my understanding. But, what I wanted to show you is, the Catholic Bible contains additional books, to what you and I would use. And you're going to see them, they're kind of underlined here. Tobit, Judith, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, Wisdom of Solomon, Ecclesiasticus, not to be confused with Ecclesiastes, Barak, or Barak, and they end up with 45. So they've got 6 additional. And these are from the, what I would call the Apocrypha. They're not inspired. Jerome, when he did the Latin Vulgate, didn't think they really belonged in the Bible, so he put them in a special section and kind of coined the phrase Apocrypha, which means hidden or secret. But it wasn't until the 1500s that the Catholic Church kind of officially put these back into their Bible. And you'll find some of their doctrine in there, but they're not inspired writings. But you might run across that and see different numbers of books in the Catholic or some of the Orthodox. And since we were on the Book of Enoch, I thought I'd just share that with you. Comments, questions? Okay. Thank you, Grant, for your help there. Okay. Were there fish in the ark? I had to smile at that one myself. But I think it's answerable. Dan says no. Okay. Now, how would you support that? Okay, Genesis. Okay, let us get there. Okay. Okay. Dan says, we were told what was brought on, and fish weren't included, so they must not have been all. Yeah. I happen to use chapter 7, but I use the same reasoning that you use. Verses 7, Noah went in and his sons and wives of clean beasts that are not clean, of fowls, and everything that creepeth on the earth. So he got clean and unclean beasts, birds, and creeping things on the earth. That's what came in. So, no mention of fish, so they must not have come in. Which would be consistent with God not doing something that's not necessary. So I have no reason to think that fish were on the ark. In fact, I would say this is one of those that's answerable. It's a little humorous, but when God says, this is what I did, then we know what he didn't do. Richard? I believe it or not, I actually thought about that driving out here. It would seem to me that he either did that or the adaptation of salt and freshwater fish occurred after the flood. And I don't know which it is. But there would have been a mixture. If pre-flood there was salt water and freshwater, there would have been a mixture, so it would have been less briny, but somewhat briny. And I just don't know which went. But yet, to answer your question, yeah, there was this commingling. So either the adaptation occurred, not evolution, the adaptation occurred after the flood, or he just performed a miracle. That would be my thing. I don't know of any indication that plants were put in the ark, but there may have been some miraculous preservation of seeds in order for that to occur. And some seeds can endure water, but they were, you have to remember the water, those things would have been underwater or in water a little over a year. You know, 40 days and 40 nights is how long it rained. Noah was on the ark about 175 days, or 375 days, pardon. Thomas. We're making a speaking thing. And that's all far as I can go. Do you want to consider a lizard a creeping thing or a fish? I would put it, since it's an air breather, I would have put it under creeping thing, but God doesn't give me that list. Kevin? Yeah. You know, it's amazing when people try to disprove the flood, you know, they just strain at this miracle, this couldn't have happened, this couldn't have happened. Well, if you accept the premise that God destroyed the earth with water, that huge miracle makes all these other miracles, he wouldn't even work up a sweat doing them. And so, you know, you just don't take the miraculous out of the ark. You know, you can do all kinds of engineering studies of how big was the ark, could all those animals just fit on it. That's irrelevant. Because you got a miracle, you're working with a miracle. Now the ark was about the size of 550 railroad boxcars, so it was a pretty big ark in terms of how much it could hold, but don't get a headache doing the math on whether the animals would, and guys have done that. Spent lifetime doing the calculations. I mean, get alive. Anybody else? Okay. Who was the man in 2 Corinthians 12, 1 through 4? And you'll remember that's where Paul is writing about the man, and he didn't know if he was in body or out of body, but he went up and came back with things he couldn't tell them. In my mind, this is an answerable one, but I won't bind that on you. Okay. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. It is not expedient for me, doubtless, to glory or to boast. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. I knew a man in Christ above 14 years ago, whether in the body I cannot tell, or whether out of the body I cannot tell, God knoweth. Such a one caught up to the third heaven, and I knew such a man, whether in body or out of the body, and I cannot tell, God knoweth. The question is, who was that man? In my mind, I have absolutely little doubt that that was Paul. Slam dunk. And I'm surer of it now than I was 2 weeks ago. And so let me share with you a little bit of what has helped me. If you go back and take these four verses in we need to keep these four verses in context. And sometimes I've been guilty of this, I just jump to chapter 12 and try to figure it out. In chapters 10 and 11, Paul is under attack, it seems, about his authority and his apostleship. So as you go through chapters 11 and 12, you begin to see a whole series of, and I lost my notes, but that's okay. There's a whole series of things that Paul says proving his authority and his apostleship. And when you get to chapter 11, verse 22, he really jumps in this with both feet. I'm a Hebrew, I'm an Israelite, a minister of Christ. And then he gives one of the rare times he tells us about all the things he's been through in verse 24, 25, 26, shipwreck, peril. And Paul was not a bragger, but he's having to hammer home the fact that he's a true apostle and he's an authoritative apostle. And then when he gets to chapter 12, and you all know that these chapter breaks were put in much later, Paul didn't put them in there, he gives, here's one more testimony of my authority. And he tells about what happened to him 14 years ago. Now, if this book was written about 56 to 58 A.D., as most people place it, this would have caused this vision, if you will, or this occurrence to happen around 42-44 A.D., which would have been several years after his Damascus vision. So this is not a repetition of something happened there. So I just don't have any doubt, and I have very little doubt. I guess, you know, there's always a little. But it just seems to me so obvious in the context of this that Paul is using this very humbly as another example to show to them that he is an authoritative, authentic apostle and trying to quell his critics. Kevin? Yes. He would have probably been, well, from the time this occurred, probably almost 50 years later, from 45 to 95. Thomas and Wade. Well, what translation is that? Okay. King James reads, "Of such a one I will not glory or boast, yet of myself I will not glory, but in my infirmity." I take that as a statement of humility. Paul is saying, I'm sharing this with you, but I'm not doing it to glory in myself. I want to share with you my weaknesses, not my boast. As I go through these verses in chapter 11, it's almost as if it's agonizing for Paul because it's embarrassing to talk about himself, but he's got to do it to refute the attack on his apostleship. Now, I don't want to read too much into that. I don't have his voice intonations, but that's the way I read these passages. Tom? This whole thorn in the flesh that we're going to see in verse 7 and following, Paul says, that was given to me so that all these things I told you about that have occurred to me keep me humble. And if verses 4, 1 through 4 of chapter 12 weren't about Paul, then verse 7 doesn't really fit in the context and the flow for me. Rex? 11 and 5? Yeah. It's interesting, and this wasn't one of our questions, but when you look at Paul's reference to himself as the book's age, you know, he goes from the chief apostle to ends up being the chief sinner. You know, it's like the closer he gets to God, the smaller he views himself, which I think is a pretty good lesson for us, too. It's kind of like that old story. I don't think it's what they were built for, but church steeples. The closer they get to God, the smaller they get. Well, that's pretty good for us. The closer we get to God, the smaller we become in our own mind. Tom? Sure. We're funny about that. We all have an ego, and we all have pride, but at the same time, usually we're most embarrassed when people are talking about us. You notice how fast most of you, and myself, will try to change the subject if there's a serious discussion about us. You know, when we're just clowning around, you know, that's a little bit different. I don't want to say this was agonizing for Paul, but he wasn't... Talking about himself was not what Paul did, but he needed to do it this time. And he'd kept this story quiet, as far as we know, for 14 years. I mean, if he wanted to go blab about this and bring glory to himself, he wouldn't have held it for 14 years. Wade? Chapter 12? Yeah. He didn't do it so that they would think highly of him. He did it so they would believe what he was telling them. Okay. We're going to be okay here. What was Paul's thorn in the flesh? I may have just thrown it away. We don't know. Okay. That's the right answer. There have been people that have sometimes I'd say the three most frequent things I run across as I'm reading is poor eyesight, epilepsy, and malaria. Well, there are some verses that can help support the eyesight one. They're not slam dunk, but I'll give them to you. Galatians chapter 4, verses 14 and 15 is probably one of the best. And I say one of the best, I'm not saying that was his thorn, but that's where he says, "And my temptation which is in my flesh I despise not nor reject, but receive me as an angel of God." And then in the latter part of verse 15 says, "I would have even been willing to pluck out my eyes for you." And some have taken that to mean, because of his poor eyesight, that was so precious to him, that was kind of the biggest gift he could give. In chapter 6 of Galatians, verse 11, it's where he talks about, "See how large a letter I have written to you with my own hand." And some have taken that to mean he had poor eyesight, so when he wrote, which often he dictated, but when he wrote, he had to write in big letters. That's possible. But we just don't know. We just don't know. The malaria one, if it has any legs at all, some people think maybe that's why John Mark left on the first missionary journey and Paul got malaria too, but kept going. But, you know, you can squeeze that turnip as hard as you want and nothing's going to come out. We just don't know. I don't know. I don't know. But it was significant enough that the Lord allowed it. Paul knew it. And it was significant enough that Paul prayed to have it taken away. We're not talking hangnail here. He prayed to have it taken away, but God chose not to. And then that famous verse in 2 Corinthians 12, the Lord says, "My grace is sufficient for you." It may have been a speaking problem. He may not have been eloquent. We just don't know. Alvin. Yeah, that would not have been something God would have allowed to have overtaken Paul, against Paul's will. Well, it's hard telling. I think that particular line of thought oftentimes maybe comes out of some of his remarks in 1 Corinthians 7 about not marrying, or some of the people that would consider him to be anti-women because of his approach on the woman's role. But obviously we know that there's no foundation for that. But, yeah. Wait. Oh yeah, I won't say that's blaspheming God, but boy, it's getting awful close to it. That's just amazing. I hope. Yeah. Yeah, they're still criticizing Paul, aren't they? They're still criticizing Paul. So. Well, Jesus said, "When they reject you, they're really rejecting me." And that was true of Paul also. Tom?
I like the idea that John Paul knew that he saw himself.
If we knew Paul had one bad eye, this is a crazy thing to say, but there'd be people that would poke one of their eyes out so they could be like Paul. Just sure as I'm standing here. Look, I'm like Paul. Well, yeah. Well, that's pretty wrong, isn't it? Okay, number 13. What kind of fruit grew on the tree of knowledge of good and evil? I got no idea. I have no idea. Now, if you want to play some metaphors or something like that, you could say, well, it was the conscience or the discernment that was the fruit. But I don't think that's what the question was. We don't know what kind of fruit it was. It's totally, I'm not dissing the question, but it's just not hardly worth us doing much with. And you've all heard that bad joke. It wasn't the fruit in the tree, it was the pear on the ground, type thing. And that's true. It's man, not the fruit. So if anybody wants to comment on that question, I'm all ears. I just don't have anything to offer. And I'm sure people ask it, but those people need to get alive too. Okay. There were two trees. And that's the one that God told them not to use. Okay, did Moses see God? This is an Exodus 33 type of a thing. In Exodus chapter 33, well, there's really two verses, and you just say, well, how can this be? Verse 11 and verse 20, Exodus 33. And the Lord spake unto Moses face to face, as a man speaketh unto his. He dropped down to 20 and he says, thou canst not see my face, for no one shall see me and live. Well, how do we put those two together? In John chapter 1, I think it's 18, no man shall see God and live. Well, obviously the Bible's not going to contradict itself. There's two ways, I think, to look at that face to face. You know, any time that we personify God, it's to help us understand. You know, it talks about the back of God, the arm or hand, the finger of God, the face of God. I'm not persuaded that he necessarily has those appendages, at least quite in the same form we do. Now, the argument there is we're created in his image, but I think that's more of a spiritual connotation than necessarily a physical connotation. The best way for me to explain it is face-to-face means open and direct. Okay? Here, Moses is having an open and a direct communication. It's not through a vision. It's not through a dream. Now, even having said that, the glory of God so imprinted itself upon Moses, you'll remember there was happened to wear the veil for a period of time. But I think the concept of face-to-face is not so much necessarily a bodily confrontation as much as it is a mental and an emotional direct confrontation of them face-to-face. I'll open it up for comments, and someone can probably do better with that than I. Wade? I found some people who, in addressing this, got around it. It didn't work for me, but when Moses saw him face to face, it was not God the Father. It was a pre-incarnate God the Son. And that you could see God the Son face to face, and you couldn't see God the Father face to face. Well, there were some pre-incarnate appearances of Christ in the Old Testament, but I didn't see anything in this text here that would warrant that interpretation. So, in the absence of that, I don't accept it. Tom?
Yeah, I like that. It's great.
Okay. We've got time. If you have a comment or something you'd like to ask on that, we will entertain it. That's my best rendition of that. Okay, I'm going to drop down to 16. Because 15, I asked for clarification, and we really couldn't come up with quite what we were after there. So I'll go back and comment on 15, but I will comment on 16 first. First Peter chapter 3, verse 16, and I think somebody took us to that verse earlier in our class. But it is a verse that does indicate that the apostles and writers were aware of each other's writings. Did I say first? Is it Second Peter? I think we wanted Second Peter, didn't we? Yeah, I wrote down First Peter. It should be Second Peter. At least Second Peter will fit with my answer better. This is a passage where Peter says, and also in his epistles, and it is a reference to Paul there in verse 15, speaking of them, saying some of which things are hard to be understood, which they that are unlearned and unstable rest with. The question is, you know, what's Peter talking about? Well, he's talking about some of Paul's letters that were hard to understand. If you want my list, it's Romans. And you might put Hebrews in there, but I find Romans to be probably, for me, the hardest of Paul's epistles. Not that we can't understand it, I just find it to be the most challenging. But for somebody else, and for Peter, it might have been one of these others. I don't know, but I would put Romans in there, right? Some people think Romans is more difficult than Revelation. I don't know if I'd go quite that far, but it's probably more I started to say it's probably more important. It's more important doctrinally. I don't want to say one passage of the Bible is more important than another, but a misunderstanding of Romans is liable to hurt you doctrinally even worse than a misunderstanding of some parts of Revelation. And I find it a difficult book. But when you take it in its totality with all the other books that Paul wrote, it unravels itself and it's a beautiful work. Did anyone else want to offer another book? I just think he's referring to some passages are hard. You bet. And they must have been hard for Peter too, so we got good company. Thomas? Yeah. I also maybe see a little bit of the change of Peter here. You know, the pre-Pentecostal day Peter would have probably said, well, I can understand that, the brashness. Here you got a guy saying, you know, there's some heavy stuff out there and I struggle with some of it. Sure, I think Acts shows a disagreement, but it also shows us how two brothers in the Lord handle that disagreement, so there isn't that split. You know, Peter had to be big enough to accept when he was wrong, and it appears he took it and went on. Correct? Yeah. And I think Jesus also said to Peter, you know, Satan's going to sift you and have his way with you so that you'll then be able to help the brethren more. Yeah. Every time we go through a difficulty, it puts us in a position to help somebody else down the road going through that same difficulty. Whether it's a divorce or loss of a child or whatever, you don't want those things to happen, but you then become more able to comfort someone going through that than some of us who haven't gone through those things. So, again, you don't want those things to happen, but you can use them for the good. Very, 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 very correct. This one, number 15, this is where it says Eve was deceived and Adam wasn't. Give examples of that application. Well, that's kind of a landmine. And I don't really know that I've got a whole lot of biblical examples. I do believe there is a difference between men and women. Women are, to their credit, in general, softer, more emotional, more compassionate. And that's a tremendous combination for godly women to bring to the table. In general, men are a little more logical and rational. Now, this is a generalization, and that may be part of why God made us that way, so that we could be leaders of the family and leaders of the church. But it's not a matter of being better. It's just a matter of being different. I wonder, and I can't prove this, and I don't force it, whether Eve it was actually the first sin. You know, and I know what Genesis 3 says, but Paul says in Romans that sin entered through that man Adam. Now he may have been using that in terms of mankind, but I could make a case back in Genesis chapter 3 that Adam dropped the ball first by not leading his family in the way of God and being led by his wife. I'm just going to kind of leave that with you, just because I kind of thought I needed to say something on number 15. But it's an interesting thought process there that Eve was deceived, which might be a reference to her emotional psyche. Adam wasn't, so he just blatantly rebelled or caved in as a wimp, however you want to picture it. And I'm not sure that's a bit better, maybe worse. Anybody have any comments or questions on anything we talked about? I didn't know it would come out quite this right on the dot timeline. I appreciate your attention. It's kind of a fun one for me, and it's kind of rapid fire, which helps a little bit after a nice meal and 3 days of studying. You are dismissed.